$1 away from corruption might result in more than $1 in money for the local economy, suggesting perhaps corruption is not just a tax, it could even be like more distortionary than that.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. In May 2003, the Brazilian central government launched an anti-corruption program targeting local government. First, there were randomized audits, then there was enforcement, and corrupt public officials and politicians were exposed and suspended. How effective was this campaign? Emanuele Colonelli of the University of Chicago Booth School can tell us, because he's one of the authors of a paper that examined the impact on local businesses and on the economy, and he joins me now. Welcome to Vox Dev Talks.
Hello, Tim. That's great to be here.
In 2013, I note from your paper that the World Bank president, Kim Yong, defined corruption as public enemy number one. But there are quite a few people that argue that a little bit of corruption in a place like Brazil, well, that might just be a good thing.
I think that gets at the very core of what we think usually of corruption. The easy answer would be that if you look at the private benefits of corruption, meaning, let's say I'm an individual who's looking to get a driving license, or I'm a firm who's looking to get a procurement contract, and I'm not the bad guy, I'm a normal person who'd like to get a basic service that they have access to. In that case, I could imagine, do I want to go through the bureaucratic process that it's going to force me to wait a long time to get the basic service I want, or do I want to pay a little extra to the public official, for example, and get the service right away? And for many people, leaving the ethical considerations aside, that might be a trade-off worth having. In that case, you get lots of firms, individuals, and so on, but tell you in certain contexts, like super bureaucratic contexts like Brazil, India, Italy, it might be good to have a little corruption. Of course, when you consider the social benefits of it, the argument gets a little bit harder to make, but still, even then, you do have quite a few people that would tell you that red tape is a much harder beast to tackle in certain countries. And so a little corruption will solve that problem to some extent. Again, it's a very complicated answer to give in details, but there are definitely a few people who would tell you that that's the case. Multinational companies might be one other typical example.
Clearly, though, the Brazilian government didn't think that the corruption it was seeing was a good thing. So tell me about this anti-corruption program, the CGU anti-corruption program.
This is probably like one of the most well-known examples of an anti-corruption program that we know, at least in the academic circles. We'll get to why. Long story short is this was a very interesting and unique program, and the data to analyze it was pretty good. Brazil is a very large country. At some point, it became clear that in certain local areas, especially the more remote rural areas, the government had very little power to stop, let's say, corrupt politicians and officials from engaging in corruption. And so this was one of the big reasons why Lula, that we've known as, of course, the president of Brazil for many years after getting elected in 2004, decided to basically run on an anti-corruption campaign that tried to say, we're going to go to all these local municipalities everywhere around Brazil. There is more than 5,500 of them. And we're going to try to crack down on the local corruption because the local people deserve better. They deserve easier, at least, access to the services. They deserve the local politicians and officials not to steal from the public finances and so on and so forth. And so what they did is what makes it even more interesting, which is in May 2003, as you said, more or less, they instituted a federal agency, the CGU, which translated more or less to English would be the Office of the Controller General, to basically ensure the transparent use of federal funds. So a main way of funding the municipalities is to transfer central federal funds to the municipalities, and then they would use it for certain programs. It could be that they would use it for an education and a health program, and so on and so forth. And so they basically just decided that they wanted to check whether the money was used according to what they were sent to the municipalities for. How do you do this? You have a massive country, you have very limited resources. As you might expect, anti-corruption is not the most popular type of activity among politicians. What they said is, we have a limited amount of funds available. We have many, many, many municipalities very far away, which is very costly to target if we want to do all of them. So let's just pick a few of them randomly and go and check. That's very cost effective because, for example, the first time they did it, they picked 60 municipalities. Think of the small and medium municipalities, not Rio de Janeiro or Sao Paulo. The big, big cities were excluded. And they would go to these few municipalities and basically check each and every receipt of a given good that was purchased. They would go and check all the contracts that were awarded to firms. So for example, TIM is supposed to provide 3 ambulances for the local municipalities. Mm-hmm. I'm going to go to TIM and I'm going to ask TIM, by the way, did you actually sell 3 ambulances to the municipalities? Where is the proof of it? And then you go back and you go to the local municipality and you say, okay, I'm supposed to take pictures of these 3 ambulances because I want to make sure that they were purchased as the contract says. They were new, they were used for these purposes. And so these auditors, usually independently selected, highly paid federal agents, they would do this for each and every contract and every type of purchase of the municipalities, and they would report all their fundings in these sometimes pretty long audit reports that would list everything that the municipality misused. That could go from severe corruption cases. Mm-hmm. That could be, for example, Tim, the politician, purchased something from a company. The company was owned by Tim's uncle, and the company got lots of money, but never delivered anything. So that would be pure stealing, pure corruption. That would be quite of a severe case. Many other examples, perhaps even the majority of examples, were, of course, less severe. Mm. That could be Tim using $100 that was supposed to be used for program A for program B. So it's less severe because at least the money was spent. Then, of course, there was diversion of funds. That's not the intended use, but they would also, like, of course, list all of these type of irregularities. So by doing this, the CGU, the anti-corruption agency was set up for this purpose, was not responsible for prosecuting the guilty parties, was just responsible for uncovering whether there was any misuse of funds. They would create these reports, they would make them public. That was it. That was therefore relatively cost effective. After that, everything was in the hands of the prosecutors, the media, and so on. And then, of course, this is part of what the program did. The program made these issues a lot more transparent, a lot more salient. And so, as you mentioned at the beginning, there were politicians that were impeached, there were public officials that went to jail, there were some firms, not many, who also paid their dues. This randomness, this way of selecting a few tiny sample of municipalities every time, they did this regularly. They started in 2003, but they did it every few months or so. That was a pretty cost-effective way of making this issue salient to many while not targeting everyone.
At this point, I'd like to get it on the record that I have done none of these things that you've accused me of. I have diverted no funds. But you do mention in the paper that it is very difficult to provide some kind of causal relationship between corruption and development. And of course, this is what you're attempting to do here. Why is it so difficult?
I think there are many reasons why. One obvious reason is that corruption is often thought of as an equilibrium outcome, meaning a country that is not born corrupt, and usually countries, let's say, or local economies that have higher levels of corruption are also perhaps poorer. They might have lower human capital in the bureaucracy and so on and so forth. So all of the relationships you see of corruption, let's say, being correlated with some development outcomes might be about corruption, might be about something else that corruption is correlated with. And it's very hard to get around this. The second big issue is that we don't even know how to define corruption at times. So what is corruption? Is it just the level of bribes that are paid in a given area? Or is it something else? Is it the incentives that politicians might have? The typical definition we have is corruption is the abuse of entrusted power or public office, let's say, for private gain. And so you think immediately of bribes that politicians extract from individuals, from firms. You might also think of just people stealing money from the federal funds, from the central funds. But what about collusion then between firms? Is that corruption? Is it not corruption? The point is, we don't often know how to define it. And so, like, I think the best strategy is typically to either define it more clearly and focus on that little thing that you want to focus on, or to find a context in which you can somehow exogenously, as we say, like, vary the extent of corruption in a certain area versus another, in a certain industry versus another. And of course, doing that is quite challenging. If you wanted to do a randomized control trial, a gold standard of evaluating the impact of something on some outcomes, it's very hard to do this in this context, not least for ethical reasons, of course. You don't want to give certain contexts more corruption than others, for example. That's not good. And so what I do in this paper is to simply look at what I think is the policy relevant analog of it, which is an anti-corruption program. Of course, it does many things. So I look at it as a bundle of a program that tries to reduce corruption on average. And that will tell me, in a context in which corruption arguably goes down more than in other contexts, I see certain outcomes. And certain outcomes, I'm going to try to argue, are changing because corruption is now lower, which essentially is a back-of-the-envelope way of getting me to what does corruption do for economic development? But again, I'm okay and happy, and probably that's the only thing I can say, to say I can estimate the impact of an anti-corruption program on a few outcomes, and we can discuss what that means. But this is a very difficult question, and I think many more studies are needed if we want to get a better understanding of what is the causal impact of corruption on development more broadly.
You're being very modest by calling it the back of an envelope calculation, because you need a lot of data. How easy was that data to get hold of?
That's a good question. I guess it was both easy and hard. So in the paper, we use a number of data sets. Some of them are social security type of data on firms and workers in the entire country in Brazil. So we're talking about millions of firms, tens of millions of individuals. And by default, that is difficult because you need approvals. This is all confidential data that you can only use for research purposes. In addition to that, of course, we put together other data sets. So like imagine trying to get information on all the public procurement contracts that were given out to firms, or reading in details all of these anti-corruption reports that I mentioned before and try to understand what's going on. So it's definitely a lot of work in that sense. When I say it's also easy, I mean that I was surprised when I was still an early stage PhD student that I could get so much data in Brazil. And that's also why we know so much about Brazil. We have so many economists working on it. Data is excellent, and you can find a lot of data depending on whether you're interested in workers, in firms, in the political economy aspects of some of these issues. And so overall, I would say it was easy because I knew I could get it. I knew other people have obtained some of these pieces of data. And so that meant a lot of work, but ultimately data that I could trust and data that could allow me to speak to a lot of nuanced aspects of corruption, which we couldn't look at before.
So does the randomness of the interventions mean that we can get to the effect of the crackdown on local firms' economic activity in the places where there were audits?
Absolutely. And that's the main contribution of what we do. We crack down on corruption in some municipalities, not others. This is due to a random lottery. So it's a national televised lottery that says, I pick Emanuele's municipality, I don't pick Tim's municipality. And so I can compare what happens in Emanuele's municipality and what happens in Tim's municipality. And I could argue the only difference was that I was picked randomly and there was an anti-corruption program targeting my municipality. We look at this program effects on local firms, economic activity more broadly, and we find that overall the effects are good. So for example, our main outcomes, because of data availability for the most part, is that the number of firms operating in the municipalities that were subject to the crackdown goes up. So there is more economic activity. Overall levels of sales of private firms go up. We see that there is more access to finance, more firms getting loans, more firms increasing their exposure to the banking sector, and a few other outcomes. But overall, we argue that this increase in economic activity seems to be consistent with reduced corruption, which you know also like happened from previous work on the political economy of these audits.
I can only imagine the reaction of the local politicians when they got picked out of the lottery. I can't imagine many of them would have welcomed it. Do we know, in any more detail, what sort of firms or sectors where the impact of the audits was the largest, why that would be?
Yes, and that's also like something we push strongly in the paper, which is if you read even just a few of these audit reports about the type of corruption that these auditors uncovered, what you see is that there is a huge emphasis of cases of public procurement, meaning the government is trying to purchase a good or a service, and there is some sort of corruption involved in it. Everything we said earlier on. Or some sort of bribes, meaning some sort of like quid pro quo between politicians, public officials, and firms, for instance. And so naturally, what we thought is that there might be some sectors, what we end up labeling government-dependent sectors, that should be particularly exposed to increases or decreases in the level of corruption. In particular, what we find is that all of the positive effects we observe, meaning corruption goes down and we see lots of economic activity increases, all of this is concentrated in these government-dependent sectors. These are sectors like construction, which are particularly exposed to public procurement, to bribes requests. So a story of this might be simply that before we had a politician that was spending a lot less than he could have spent, she could have spent on a given program. Now, because of the anti-corruption program, there is less of that stealing of public resources, and therefore just simply more money is spent on the local economy. And therefore, more firms are needed to serve those extra goods and services that are requested by the local economy. And there are many other stories for why these specific sectors might be affected. But the natural one, of course, is that they are the ones that are exposed to the corruption in the first place.
I imagine that the randomness was intended to be a deterrent for other municipalities, cut down on your corruption just in case you are audited. That way they can get the maximum value for what they do. Do we have evidence that that deterrent worked?
Yes, and that's also one of the original goals of this type of policies. As we mentioned earlier, you can't possibly expect to check every single receipt or every single use of funds around the country at every level of the bureaucracy. So one reason why these audits are random is because they don't want anybody to expect their coming, of course, but also because by doing so, sure, they will not target every single municipality in this context, but they will make it such that some municipalities will be aware of an increased risk of corruption. Meaning, we pick TIM as the mayor, the municipality is going to be audited. Mm-hmm. TIM, therefore, will react in a certain way, and that's what our effects we just discussed are about. At the same time, it could be that there is Emanuele, who is the mayor in a nearby municipality. In a context like Brazil, in a context where corruption is rampant, and usually nobody, at least at this stage, used to get punished. And so now that I see TIM going down, I might be more careful myself. That's essentially what we find, at least to some extent in the data, meaning economic activity does not only go up in TIM's municipality, which is audited, but also in the nearby ones. And so this is what we call the spillover effects of this anti-corruption program on the local economic activity, which are consistent with other type of spillover effects based on deterrence, the deterrence power of anti-corruption programs that we saw in this context as well, in previous work, in other contexts on international initiatives on anti-corruption. And so that's what we find in the data. And I think that's probably like one of the most interesting aspects of the anti-corruption program once you get to understanding the cost benefit of the program itself.
Yes, talk about that cost benefit, because once you put together what you save directly and the good effect of those indirect deterrents, does this work out as good value for money? Because I, as you say, it's very difficult to get funding for these sort of programs.
This is always where it gets to a point in which you have to make assumptions. It's very hard to pinpoint exactly the value generated in dollar terms. We do try in the paper to give some sort of an estimate. Long story short is, it seems to be the case that these audits are quite good value for money. They're relatively cheap. So previous estimates of the cost of doing these audits on average is something like $50,000 for an audit, meaning for sending a team of auditors, spending 2 or 3 weeks in the municipality, checking everything, reporting, writing up the report. And so given that, what we find, which is once you account for spillover effects, you see something like a 2% increase of economic activities, especially in certain sectors that are, as we discussed, more exposed to the anti-corruption program. These are like relatively big effects once you put some sort of a dollar amount on them for relatively cheap. Of course, the caveat here is that this is due to this specific program at this specific point in time. Brazil was very much not in the anti-corruption discussion before, which means these effects might be stronger than they would be if you did them in the US, maybe. I don't know. My point is, I want to caution against extrapolating too much. But certainly in this case, it looked like the money was well spent in the time period that I studied.
Yes, you come out with a multiplier, don't you? And that multiplier is bigger than one.
Correct. Which would suggest, if you allow me to make more suggestive statement, but it does suggest that $1 away from corruption might result in more than $1 in money for the local economy, suggesting perhaps corruption is not just a tax. It could even be like more distortionary in that.
So we have a program that has been successful at every level, really. It's cut down on corruption. It's cost effective. It's ethically a good thing to do. Would this program be an effective template for anti-corruption activities in other countries? Because there is corruption everywhere. Or is there something distinctively Brazilian about it?
In a sense, it is already, right? I don't know whether other countries necessarily use this as a template or whether they came to create a certain template that resembles the Brazilian template quite a bit. We have randomized anti-corruption audits already present in a lot of contexts.
Yes,
so just to give you one example, I've been working with the anti-corruption agency in Uganda on an intervention trying to understand what happens when you target transparency in the construction sector, for example. But in that case, I was surprised also to know that Uganda itself also does some randomized audits of public entities. It's different. It's not municipalities, but it's a very similar design. And the idea is, again, we want to keep it random because we want to make sure that we hit value for money. And at the same time, we can make sure that everybody is aware that we might crack down on them. And so this is happening, not everywhere. Like in my own country, in Italy, you have a lot less of this. You have a lot more focus on very in-depth prosecution of big cases, which tend to be very endogenous in nature, meaning you go where you have more indications that there might be a lot of corruption, where you know that there is something probably very wrong happening. And so you use a lot of resources on a few very important cases. To what extent one is better than the other, it's very hard for me to say. It goes back to the point of external validity. I can't say whether this is a good template or not. What I do know that, for example, in the Brazilian context, they definitely plan to keep a lot of the features of this original randomized program. In particular, I remember talking to the anti-corruption agency a few years back, and they were telling me how they plan to incorporate in the future a mix of this randomness in which municipalities are selected, but also training machine learning models to detect areas that are more prone to corruption.
I see, yes.
And so a mix of the randomized component plus using data to predict where it's more likely to have an impact, that seems to be a good way forward. But I would love to see, and also to conduct myself, of course, more studies to better understand what other features of the program might be useful.
At least based on this research, those spillover effects really change the cost-benefit equation, don't they, if we can establish that they are consistent everywhere?
And that begs the question, is it going to be so in the long term? We don't know. People adjust. Mm-hmm. People are very good at being corrupt if they want to, which means that I have more questions than answer. But yeah, you're pretty spot on.
There are a lot of questions, and I'm looking forward to hearing about what happens when they get answered. For now, Emanuele, thank you very much.
Thank you, Tim. It's been a pleasure.
The paper is called Corruption and Firms, and the authors are Emanuele Colonelli and Munu Prem, published in the Review of Economic Studies in July 2021. This has been a Vox Dev Talk. The best way to make sure you don't miss an episode of Vox Dev Talks is to subscribe on your podcast platform. Go on, do it now. But always, you are able to find our past episodes at voxdev.org.